Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 306 for March 5th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
I asked the guys if they'd sell it to me, and they said, sure. And I said, why don't you sell it? And they said, well, you know, marketing won't let us sell it. They don't think anybody will buy it. So that was about 7 years ago. And, you know, in retrospect, it looks brilliant. But, you know, back then, nobody bought rye. And I had a lot of people tell me, you know, you're going to lose your shirt.
That's David Perkins, the founder of Utah's High West Distillery. David's name has come up in the last couple of episodes, most recently when he was named Industry Pioneer of the Year by Malt Advocate magazine. More with David in a few minutes, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. The results of Whiskey Magazine's annual World Whiskies Awards competition were announced on Thursday night in London, just before the start of Whiskey Live London. Suntory's Yamazaki 1984 was named the world's best single malt whiskey, while Hanke Bannister 40-year-old was named the world's best blended whiskey. James Martin's 30-year-old from Glenmorangie was named the world's best blended malt. Parker's Heritage Collection 10-year-old weeded bourbon from Heaven Hill took the title of world's best North American whiskey, while Cooley's Green Ore 15-year-old was named the world's best grain whiskey. And finally, Drambuie's The Royal Legacy of 1745 rounds out the top winners as world's best whiskey liqueur. Now, those are the overall winners. There were also winners in 18 different categories. Just a few of the highlights. Glenmorangie's Signet was named Best Highland Single Malt. The Springbank 12-year-old Best Campbellton. Beaumont Tempest won Best Isla. Highland Park 25-year-old Best Island Whiskey Other Than Islas. Glenfarclas 40-year-old Best Speyside, and Auchentoshan 1998 Sherry Matured won Best Lowland. Bushmills 16-year-old won the Best Irish Single Malt category. Redbreast 15 won the Best Irish Pot Still. Cavillan's Solist won Best Rest of the World Single Malt. And Hibiki 21-year-old the Best Japanese Blended Whiskey. Three Ships Bourbon Cask Finish from South Africa won Best Rest of the World Blended Whiskey. Now, that one comes from the James Sedgwick Distillery in South Africa, which also won Whiskey Magazine Icons of Whiskey Award as the Brand Innovator of the Year. The global winners in the Icons competition were also announced along with the World Whiskies Awards winners. William Grant and Sons won Distiller of the Year honors. White & Mackay's Richard Patterson was named Whiskey Ambassador of the Year. The Speyside Cooperage was named Visitor Attraction of the Year. Among retailers, the Whiskey Exchange took Online Retailer of the Year honors, Gordon & McPhail's Shop in Elgin took Single Outlet Retailer of the Year, and Royal Mile Whiskey's Multiple Outlet Retailer of the Year. And finally, retired Diageo Distillery Manager and current Brand Ambassador Evan Catnack was given the Icons of Whiskey Lifetime Achievement Award. That's not Evan's only Lifetime Achievement Honor of the Week. Malt Advocate magazine gave him its Lifetime Achievement Award as well. That announcement came at the beginning of the week as Malt Advocate wound up its annual awards. Last May, we met Lagavulin Distillery Manager Peter Campbell during the Fay Gill series. Peter is moving to the mainland now as the new manager at Diageo's Cardew Distillery in Speyside. He's being replaced by Georgie Crawford, who moves to Islay from Glenord and previously ran the Talisker brand home on Skye. It's believed that Georgie is the first woman to manage a distillery on Islay since the legendary Bessie Williamson at Laphroaig. In other news, rye lovers will have a new whiskey to look for. Tom Bullitt has been working quietly behind the scenes on the first new whiskey to carry his family's name since the original Bullitt Bourbon was introduced.
Some time ago, Richard Nichols and I were talking about 7 years ago, actually. I don't know if you remember Richard, absolutely wonderful man. He has now left the business and decided he wanted to teach high school math. But at the time, he was the senior vice president of the North American Whiskey Portfolio. And we were talking about if we went somewhere with Bullitt, where would we go? And I said, well, we had a wonderful partnership. We commenced a wonderful partnership with Seagram's in 1997 and had all alternatives available to us. And implemented fully our family recipe, 2/3 corn, 1/3 rye, more or less. So, and I like the proof, 90 proof. I like the age. Our whiskeys don't get any better after 8 years, between 6 and 8 years. So, I liked everything about the product. But I said, you know, we've got a nice footprint in rye. To my knowledge, it's the highest in rye of the bourbon mash bills. Maybe let's just make a straight small batch rye and gamble that they'll come to something. And I guess we lucked out. They have come to something, haven't they?
Now, this is a 95% rye, right?
We wanted to get the highest rye content we could and still maintain a natural process. Greg, our master distiller, would say we wanted to let the natural enzymes come from the cereals as opposed to tweak it chemically. So 95 is about as high as you can go and do that. We also like the taste profile of the 95. And at 95, it is probably, to my knowledge, one of the highest mash bills, straight rye mash bills. A rye, of course, is 51%. A straight rye is 80, and all the way up to 95 is very ambitious. And then also, it's like the bourbon from a price-value ratio. It's very, very well priced.
Now, you're actually having this made at LDI down in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, right?
We sure are, and delighted with that. Our production infrastructure that is carried forward at this point is the old Seagram production infrastructure. And as we both know, in my personal experience, there is no higher quality culture than that the Brofmans used to maintain. So we're over there, and we're delighted with it. I find it's a little funny and kind of ironic that we make the bourbon below Mason-Dixon line and the rye above it, which of course would be historically correct.
But some of the content for the bullet bourbon comes out of there too, right?
No, all of our bourbon comes out of Kentucky. We have, I think, the regulations for straight whiskey require that it come out of a still and doesn't have to come out of Kentucky, but all of our bourbon comes out of Kentucky.
Okay. When will this be available and where?
Well, it should be generally available and more or less coming into the market now. In some markets, I think maybe in the metro market in New York there and in the city of San Francisco, some of our primary markets, it is available. But in due course, it should be by the end of this month or the next, as it filters it down through the distribution chain, it should be generally available. And we literally pushed the project back from fall to spring so we would be able to keep in good supply. We're bottling 4, 5 to 7 years, the same as the bourbon, not any particular age target, but a maturity target.
Now, as you've said before, the bullet bourbon is based on the old family recipe from, if I remember this correctly, the number of greats in this, your great-great-great-grandfather?
Two greats, great-great-grandfather,
okay.
Augustus, he would have called himself Augustus Boulay. He was French, and my great-grandfather, John Joseph, changed the pronunciation to bullet, anglicized it to bullet.
How would Augustus have felt about his name going on a whiskey that differs from the family recipe?
Well, I think it's, of course, include myself in the family. So it continues the family tradition, and then we're very proud of the fact we did a nice job as my dear friend Fred and distant cousin Fred Noe would say, what's in the bottle counts the most, but the bottle, the package is nice. We built the same glass. The glass will say in exactly the same mold, other than the fact that the raised glass on the front will say Bullet Rye and then American Whiskey, and then Hollis, our daughter Hollis Bullet, who is an artist and ambassador for us, went to the Pantone chart and picked out a nice green label, took to that Swatch label across the front. So we're pleased with the package as well.
I'll be getting a sample of the new Bullet Rye soon. I'll have tasting notes on a future episode. Meanwhile, the final expression in Glenglassaugh's series of Manager's Legacy Drams is out now. It honors Walter Grant, who ran the distillery from 1962 to 1967, and comes from a sherry cask filled in 1967. A bit of trivia, Walter Grant was responsible for giving current Glenglassaugh Managing Director Stuart Nickerson his first distillery manager's job back in 1984. Grant was production director at Highland Distillers back then and hired Nickerson to manage Highland Park. Now, I just received samples of the Walter Grant bottling and the rest of the Manager's Legacy Series drams. I'll have tasting notes for that one later in this episode. And finally, the King's Barns Distillery Project has reached a key milestone. Scotland's Fife Council has approved plans to build the Distillery and Visitors Center on the Steading on the Cambo Estate near St. Andrews. King's Barns Principal Doug Clement is moving forward now with financing the project through share sales and grant funding. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. The emails of the week are sponsored this time around by Oban. First off, I need to correct an error from the last episode. In my response last week to Christopher Azrak's request for good whiskey bars in Las Vegas, I said the Whiskey Attic had gone out of business. In fact, the Attic remains open, but its website is down for redesigning. I do regret the error. On that note, Turner Moore in Sarasota, Florida emailed me this week. He's planning a trip to Boston in May and is looking for a good whiskey bar. If you have suggestions, please let me know and I'll pass them along. And if you know of a good whiskey bar, no matter where it is, just send me the details and I'll add it to the list of whiskey bars on the resources page of the WhiskeyCast website. Had a lot of comments on the last episode and my visit to the Brown-Forman Cooperage in Louisville. Mark Robinzek posted this on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. I've been listening to the podcast since last October and I love listening. I found the latest episode of the Brown-Forman Cooperage to be incredibly fascinating. As lovers of whiskey, we must talk about the wood that our beloved spirit spends its formative years in, but it's rare that we get to learn about the wood's origin. The conversation of toasting and charring was also great. Thanks for taking a different angle with the episode. Well, I've posted some photos from the visit on the Facebook page as well. Amanda Mooney had this comment. Coopering is definitely an art form. Very proud to have a dad who is one of the few remaining master coopers in Scotland. Thank you for the great pictures. Now, if you have a question, a comment, or a suggestion, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and you can always use the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, too. The emails of the week are brought to you by Oban Single Malt Whiskey, from the coastal town of Oban since 1794. Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. Tickets are still available for the Whiskey Guild's Whiskey Classic on March 10th in Morristown, New Jersey. The Universal Whiskey Experience is March 18th and 19th in Las Vegas. The U.S. chapter of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society has single malt extravaganzas on March 16th in New York City, the 24th in Phoenix, and on the 30th in Atlanta. You can use the discount code WC11 to get tickets at the Society members' price when you use the Society website. Whiskey Schiff is March 25th and 26th in Luzerne, Switzerland, and the Whiskey Festival Nordnederland is the 25th in the Dutch city of Groningen. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay. Utah's High West Distillery has been getting a lot of time on WhiskeyCast in the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, American Craft Spirits blogger Matt Colglazier mentioned High West's whiskeys among his spirits to watch. And last time around, I mentioned that High West founder David Perkins was named Malt Advocate Magazine's Industry Pioneer of the Year. I talked with David this week, and that's where we began the conversation.
What did you think when you heard about the Malt Advocate Award the other day?
Little old me? That's what I thought. Little old me? Dumb guy from Utah?
What's it mean for a little guy from Utah, little old you, to win an award like that?
Yeah. Come on. It's kind of a big, big surprise for a guy that's just following his dream, but, you know, not on a big scale like some of the other guys are. So it was pretty cool.
Now, John Hansel, in his comments, compared you very favorably to John Glazer at Compass Box, in that you guys both are creating unusual whiskeys from stuff that other folks had distilled and putting them together into some really unusual combinations. And John has gotten a lot of rave reviews for his blends over the years. I know you're starting to put together your own whiskeys at the distillery out in Utah, but how do you feel about that comparison?
Well, I'm indeed honored. I mean, I know John Glazer. I mean, we're not, you know, great friends because we just don't know each other that well, but I've seen him at whiskey shows, and I consider him a friend. And I sure like the comparison. I don't know how he'd like it, but doggone, it sure is an honor to be in the likes of John, because I think he's a really smart, you know, just a great, great guy, smart guy, been in the business for a long time, and it's what an honor.
Tell me what you're doing with your whiskeys and how you got started in all this, because, like John, you did not come from within the whiskey industry, right?
No, I did not. I mean, I wish I had John's prior job. I would have loved it. I think it would have been a lot better. You know, be a product manager at a big company, you sure would learn a lot. I actually started life in biochemistry in a lab, and then I made my way through the ranks and worked through drug companies. But I got into marketing and drug companies. I sort of did what John did, but for drugs rather than booze. And it's fun. You really get to see a neat perspective on a market, but to understand it, you know, being in the business for years, it's just you learn so much.
How did you make the transition to whiskey?
You know, I just I followed my dream. I my wife and I went to a wedding in Kentucky 1 year, about 10 years ago, and on a whim, we said, you know, what the heck, let's go to Maker's Mark, and we did. At the time, we were living in Northern California. And we've been to Napa a lot, and we love Napa, we love wine, but I always had a soft spot in my heart for whiskey. And the tour, we went to Maker's Mark, and the tours, you know, I think it's a lot better now. It was less than satisfying then. I think that the tours in Napa are very sophisticated. The one in Kentucky just sort of left me yearning for more answers, just because it was kind of folksy and, you know, catered to a lower denominator. And that's when I started moonlighting, saying, you know, God, there's got to be a market for higher class and upping the sophistication of American whiskey drinker, and that was kind of my start.
And how did you start sourcing your whiskeys? Because the whiskey industry is a very tightly knit business, and it's kind of hard for new guys to get in.
Yeah, indeed. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, the bottom line is I knew the right guy. I got very, very lucky when I started moonlighting. I actually got in touch with Jim Rutledge at Four Roses, and he was very gracious, very kind, and talked to me and gave me answers to questions I had, and I flew out to Kentucky to meet with him and spend some time at Four Roses, and he basically, I wouldn't be here today if it weren't for Jim, and he taught me everything I know, and he also was instrumental in my early business model that said, you know, gosh, if you're going to sock some stuff away and save it for a few years, how are you going to survive? And that was his question, and his answer was, you know, go slush some whiskey. And he said, you know, there's eight stores in Kentucky making whiskey in 300 brands. You know, a lot of people out there sourcing whiskey and saying they distilled it, but they didn't. That didn't really fit well with me because it was in my DNA to make my own. But, you know, it became clear that made a lot of sense. And we were looking for bourbon, and you couldn't buy bourbon to save your life. And he said, you know, you ought to think about rye. And I'd never really thought much about rye, to be honest. And then I had these ryes, and I thought, God dang, this is some of the best stuff I'd ever had. Elegant, beautiful whiskey. And I asked the guys to sell it to me, and they said, sure. And I said, why don't you sell it? And they said, well, you know, marketing won't let us sell it. They don't think anybody will buy it. So that was about 7 years ago. And, you know, in retrospect, it looks brilliant. But, you know, back then, nobody bought rye. And I had a lot of people tell me, you know, you're going to lose your shirt. So I was scared for a few years.
Tell me how you came up with the idea to mix bourbon and rye. For burr rye?
You know, to be honest with you, I'm not exactly sure. I just know one night my wife and I were sitting together, and we had just gotten some samples of, I had a guy call me that said, hey, I got some Four Roses, 10-year-old, do you want it? And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do with that. And I said, well, send me a sample. So we did. My wife were tasting it, and it was good. And then, you know, I guess the inspiration was, well, you know, you got blended scotch where they're blending Islay with Highland, and you know, rye is kind of the Islay, if you will, of American whiskey, so why not blend Islay in America with Highland or bourbon? And you know, that's what we did. And I thought it really tasted different than what you'd call a high rye bourbon. because it didn't. It had a different taste profile, where the rye spice kicked in a little later, and we thought that was so unusual. And we experimented. We probably did 30 different blends, and it was good. So we said, "What the heck?" You know, and I kind of had, you know, well, heck, John Glazer can do it. Why can't I? So that's, you know, I'd say I admired John a lot and had him in my mind, and just the idea of being a little crazy, and the jackalope came up. You know, if you're going to mix two things, you know, and, you know, it was mythical Western creatures. So it just happened all in one night, believe it or not.
And the whiskey that you're probably most well known for with High West is the Rendezvous Rye. Tell me about that one.
Well, Rendezvous, like I said, I got several different stocks of rye whiskey made at two different distilleries. And one was made at the old Seagram's plant, the Lawrenceburg Distillers plant now. And we got several different ages of that. And then I got some rye made at Barton, which really nobody knew about. And they have a rye that they sell called Fleischmann's, but it's not widely distributed. And this stuff was 16 years old, and I got two different mash bills. It was straights. And then also there was a 21-year-old, and it was not a straight. And I remember buying it, and the people, you know, selling it to me said, you know, you can't call this a straight. And they, you know, they weren't sure I really would want it since it wasn't straight, which just goes to show how important straight is in the Kentucky world. You know, but I said, well, you know, this is really beautiful, amazing stuff. I don't care if you call straight or not. I'll take it. Anyway, so we got those stocks, and then with the Ronnie, the 6-year-old LDI stuff was delicious. But the idea to blend in the older stock because it just had a richer profile, I thought, why not? So that's what I did. And you know, it takes a beautiful whiskey, but it just adds components of each, and it's 1 + 1 = 3. So it came to me pretty naturally, actually.
Let's clarify something here, because you mentioned the initials LDI, and people who are really inside whiskey know what that is. It's the Lawrenceburg Distillery in Indiana, right?
That's right, yeah.
That makes... it doesn't make any whiskeys on its own. I know it's owned by Angostura, but it doesn't really make any whiskeys that it makes on its own label, so as far as I know, right? They make whiskeys for a lot of different people, but it's one of these that supplies to you and to other folks until they get their own distilleries in place like you're doing with yours, right?
Well, I mean, that's not their reason for being. I mean, they're owned by Seagram's, then Diageo bought them, and then, Diageo bought the brands, but Pernod Ricard got the plant. And then Pernod was going to shut the plant down, and that's when, you know, they were looking for someone to buy. Then the plant went, I guess, self. The employees bought it up, and I guess Angostura came in and rescued them. But, yeah, I mean, basically, you know, Diageo is their biggest purchaser of product. And, you know, now a lot of people are in on the game. But, yeah, the old Seagram's plant, probably the largest distilled spirits plant in the world that nobody knows about. And they make some of the most amazing products in the world.
Including some of your stuff. Now, what are you working on now that you've got your own distillery out in Utah?
Our reason for being is distilling and making whiskey. And we've been distilling since mid-2007. And our first product was a vodka, just because obviously a lot of people do it. You don't have to age it. We've been making whiskey since about mid-2008. We're putting that down and ramping up. But the idea to outsource while we're making our own just seemed to make sense. Because, you know, frankly, I don't like young whiskey. And I didn't want to launch a young whiskey. And I guess we've got the luxury of not having to launch ours young. But I can't wait till it comes out, and I can't wait for people to taste it.
How long do you think you'll wait before you can bottle your own stuff?
You know, I don't know. I mean, everybody asks the question, and I'm, you know, until it's right, I would say at least a year and a half from now. You know, if we've built up enough stock so we won't run out. I mean, the stuff we have aging now I think is pretty dang good. But, you know, I'd like to wait 4 years if I could. So that's kind of the idea. But we're making a rye, of course. Rye's kind of our shtick, but we're also making a scotch, which, of course, I can't call scotch because it's not aged for 3 years and made in Scotland, but we're making a malt whiskey is what we call it here, and it's delicious. Our distiller's name's Brendan Coyle. He was a former brewer, and he went to graduate school at Harriet Watt in Edinburgh for his master's in brewing and distilling, And he's a great, great distiller, and we're looking forward to showing the world our whiskeys here when they're ready.
You also have done a lot of experimentation, not just with rye, but one of the whiskeys that I've had the chance to try of yours, you do some stuff with oats that's quite unusual.
Yeah, when I quit my job and started this, I bought a little mini still, a 5 gallon still from Holstein, which is the German maker, one of the German makers of stills. And you know, the idea was just to experiment, see if A, I could make whiskey, B, if it was any good, and then C, run some different experiments. And I distilled every grain I could. And oats, for me, I just had a love affair with them. They have a wonderful, wonderful taste. And, you know, there's a reason people eat oats for breakfast, because they have a good taste. They're not too strong. They're very subtle and beautiful, vanilla-ish, nuttiness. And they make a nice whiskey. So I would always bring around a White Dog for people to taste, just for education purposes. You know, this has been 3 years, and suddenly in the last year, the desire to drink white whiskey has exploded, particularly with, you know, good craft bartenders. And someone said, you know, why don't you launch your oat whiskey? So we did. And, you know, we were very blessed and lucky. It won a nice award at the American Stilling Institute competition last year. We actually tied for first with Koval, has a nice white or unaged rye. And you know, they're very, very different whiskeys, but they're very elegant, beautiful, and just as good as a white rum or white tequila.
What else are you working on in that line with different grains and different mash bills?
I think we're probably going to stick to rye, scotch, and our oat whiskey. We're aging our oat. You know, we'll see if it's good enough when it gets aged to launch as an aged product or not. But we're definitely a rye company, and not our scotch. Well, I keep using the word, but you know what I mean when I say it. Our malt whiskey is utterly delicious. And I really can't wait for that to come out. But we're also experimenting with bourbon as well. And you just have to focus as a small company and not spread yourself too thin.
Now, one thing I've asked your colleague and competitor, Jess Graber, about, and it's something that probably you and Jess are about the only ones who would have any experience with this, in terms of distilling at high altitudes, because he's up at a mile high in Denver. You're in Utah, up near the mountains. Is there any difference in the distillation process and how long you have to run your spirit runs and things like that with being at high altitude compared to being down at sea level or close to it like most other distilleries are?
Well, I mean, all I can tell you are the hypothetical differences. I can't tell you in the practical sense because I haven't done both. But there's no difference. I mean, there's no doubt that it is different because the vapor pressure is lower at altitude, so things boil at lower temperatures. So our water boils at roughly 201 here versus 212, and that means your alcohol boils lower. So I guess the bullshit artist in me could say, well, we're cooking our stuff at lower temperatures, so we're ruining flavor less. You know, I don't know. That's probably it's certainly true that we're cooking at lower temperature, but how that's going to affect the flavor, I really couldn't tell you.
That's something I've wondered about with a lot of people, just because I'd love to know if it proves to make any difference over time. But it's something that both of you guys have only been really distilling 3 to 5 years now, so we really won't see for a few more years yet whether there is an effect.
Yeah, I mean, you know, will it be different? I don't honestly know if it makes that big a difference. So, I mean, you know, in tequila, they distill tequila at 7,000 feet as well, and I think the difference is more hypothetical than it is real.
You having fun?
Yeah, you know, we're having a whole lot of fun. I think for me, the idea to follow your passion and have something to get you out of bed in the morning where you're smiling, and it's hard to beat. But I think the funnest part is right now, I think whiskey's so underappreciated. And I think for us, just turning people on to whiskey, because most of the people that come by our place, we have a restaurant. And so we have a real laboratory here for, you know, testing our whiskeys and using it in food and pairing it with food. And I'd say the majority of the people that come by don't know much about whiskey, but they think they should, and they want to try. And we turn more people on to whiskey. So, you know, whiskey's going through a real boom now, and that's a lot of fun. It's fun to be part of that.
And I have to ask, you're located in Park City, Utah, and as we all know, Utah is not one of the more alcohol-friendly states of the Union. How do you get around all that? How do you get around the perception that Utah might as well be a dry state for all intents and purposes?
Well, most of that's perception versus reality. and getting around it's actually pretty easy. So I think we've actually been very lucky to a lot of the tourist groups here in Utah that like promote the state. They're very, very happy to promote a distillery because it's kind of a sign that you can get a drink in Utah. And, you know, I think once people come here, they get it that, yeah, that we have bars just like anyone else and people don't have hands going out of their heads and stuff like that. But we did have bars where you had to join a private club to get in, and the governor a couple of years ago was smart enough to get rid of that. So you can get a drink just like anywhere else. In fact, I think some of our laws are even better. But the reality is a lot of alcohol laws are screwed up in every state.
Where do you see yourself 10 years from now?
Well, I hope I'm skiing a little bit more than I am now. I moved to Park City to ski a bit, but unfortunately this job's cut into my ski time. I get to travel a lot and work a lot, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. I'm having a good time. But, you know, hopefully 10 years from now we're still in business. It's a brutal business to get into. You need major staying power and capital. I think it's harder than the brewing business. And you got big guys that, you know, breathing down your throat you got to compete against. And, you know, so far the craft movement's doing well, and you know, we're not a fraction of the big guys. But I think with more brewers, it's just like coffee was in the 90s when there was Starbucks on every corner. And they actually expanded the market for coffee because you had a lot of boutique coffee companies. And I think that's what's going to happen with the craft distillers. So I hope we're in business in 10 years.
I had tasting notes for a couple of David's whiskeys in the last episode. You'll find those at the WhiskeyCast website as well. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with another whiskey from a recent episode. I discussed the Ardmore Project single cask bottling with Ryan Maloney of Julio's Liquors and Ardmore manager Alistair Longwell back in episode 303. It went on sale last weekend at Julio's annual Whiskey A Go-Go event in Westboro, Massachusetts. Now, Ryan was kind enough to send me a bottle. The nose is full of peat, honey, caramel, and heather notes. The taste starts off with caramel and baked apples, then slowly turns peaty with a nice smokiness that carries into the long finish, along with vanilla and heather notes. I hope we'll see more single casks out of Ardmore in the future. I'm scoring the Ardmore Project a 93. Now, I mentioned the Glenglassaugh Manager's Legacy Series bottling honoring former manager Walter Grant earlier. It's a 1967 single sherry cask bottled at 40.4% ABV. Peachy is the word that best describes this one. The nose is aromatic and sweet with peach pie and a touch of honey. The taste is creamy and smooth with peach nectar, a touch of cinnamon, honey, and a hint of roasted almonds. The finish is peachy and long. It's excellent. I'm scoring the Walter Grant Manager's Legacy bottling from Glenglassaugh a 94. Finally, I had the chance to taste a classic this week thanks to my good friend and fellow malt maniac, Peter Silver. He opened up a bottle of 22-year-old Dalwhinnie from Cadenheads, distilled in 1957 and bottled in 1979 at 45.7% ABV. Now, 32 years after bottling, it's still vibrant with a great nose full of spices, including hazelnut, allspice, and cinnamon with touches of smoke and toasted oak. The taste is thick, mouth-coating, and spicy with a great cinnamon note that fades to reveal licorice and orange peel, while the finish just goes on and on with hints of cinnamon, allspice, and oak. I'm scoring it a 94, even though I figure it's almost impossible to find a bottle today. And thanks again to Peter Silver for letting me taste it. More on that in just a second. You'll find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The iPhone and iPad app is sponsored by the Glenrothes. The Android edition is sponsored by Ben Romick. My notes are also available at the WhiskeyCast website, and that's also where you'll find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. Now, I've mentioned Peter Silver on the show recently. Again, he's a fellow malt maniac. He's also known as New York City's jazz dentist,
and has been fighting a successful battle against liver cancer for the last few months. In fact, Peter's big band performed the other night for the first time since he was diagnosed with liver cancer. Blue Nitrous headlined at the legendary nightclub The Bitter End, and I'll leave you now with one of the highlights of the evening. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening, and here's Blue Nitrous.
Thank you. What do you think? These guys really feel that they're wrong.